proceed next in the matter of People v. Susan Wells. Carolyn. Justice Baxter has recused himself from participation in this case, and we're very pleased to have with us, sitting by assignment, the Honorable Walter Krosky, Associate Justice of the Second Appellate District, Division 3, sitting as a Justice Pro Tem of this Court by assignment. You may proceed, Campbell.
May it please the Court, Elizabeth Campbell for Ms. Wells. The briefing in this case has provided an extensive review of the various approaches taken by courts around the country in cases involving anonymous tips of drunk or erratic driving. It is important to note that at the outset today that while there are many routes to reversal in this case, only one road leads to affirmance. In order to uphold the traffic stop in this case, this court must adopt a per se bright line rule that not only dispenses with the need to corroborate an anonymous tip if that tip concerns erratic driving, but also significantly lowers the threshold of reasonable suspicion in such cases.
Did the prosecution establish in the trial court that there was indeed an anonymous tip?
We don't know the source of the tip, Your Honor. All we have is a dispatch report. As far as we know, the Court of Appeal treated this as an anonymous tip, presumably because the source of the tip was not known.
But no evidence was presented by the prosecution that there was indeed an anonymous tip, right?
No, and that is important because in the cases that we've discussed in the briefing, most of the time we know that it is a 911 call, and some of those courts have chosen to treat 911 calls as different than other kinds of police tips. But in this case, we really don't have any idea. There's assumptions that can be made and that certainly were made in the Court of Appeal opinion, but we have no evidence.
Can it logically be inferred from the facts that we do know that this came from an anonymous tip?
I think it can only be inferred if we sort of backtrack on the facts. One of the things I wanted to point out today is that the 911 calls are often considered to be more reliable because they're contemporaneous, because someone sees the erratic driving or whatever and immediately makes the telephone call. In this case, we don't even know that it is contemporaneous, except that the officer, a few minutes after the dispatch report, sees a car that meets the vague description that he's been provided. So we assume that there was a call a few minutes before. But we don't actually know that there was a call a few minutes before. We only have a dispatch report, and 2 minutes later, a blue van passes the location.
In the absence of a dangerous situation, what transpired here would never be thought to qualify as reasonable suspicion of anything. Am I correct?
Certainly not, and certainly not without a known tipster or a known source.
Well,
which we
extent?
Don't have. But I'm sorry.
Right.
But given the fact that an automobile has been called a dangerous instrumentality, does that not change the balance here?
I think it could change the balance in a particular type of case and with particular evidence that we don't have in the situation. We have so little in the situation that I think it would be really a mistake to for this court to adopt a drunk driving exception, as some of the courts have, based on these facts. We don't know. We have weaving, which certainly can be a dangerous situation. It can also be someone has a child who's acting up in the car and the car weaves within the lane. We don't know that we crossed lanes. We don't have.
The tip here is weaving all over the highway, isn't it?
I believe that was one of the descriptions, yes.
So we're talking about a little deviation within the lane. Weaving all over the highway is different.
Weaving all over the highway is more than weaving within a lane. We don't have a description of other traffic on the road. We don't have a speed.
But isn't that description in and of itself potentially dangerous?
Certainly, it's potentially dangerous. I'm not sure that it's enough of a danger has been described by this sparse description to justify both dispensing with the need to corroborate the tip and also lowering.
What would you add to these facts to make it potentially dangerous?
I think we can look at the other cases that are cited in the briefing for some examples. We have situations where there's heavy traffic, where I think we have at least one cited in the briefing where there's more than one report because this person is weaving in and out between cars. In that situation, then you start to get closer to the bomb analogy, where someone is in heavy traffic, rush hour. I think that was the Hawaii case, and there's multiple traffic violations that have been seen. And just to be clear, we're not talking about an officer's reasonable suspicion to make a stop. We're talking about we don't have much of an ID in this case. We see a car that matches the vague description, we better stop it. Because
the cases recognize that automobiles are different, totally apart from the question of how egregious the conduct was here. They're mobile, and they are instruments that are inherently dangerous to other individuals. And isn't that enough to cause us to treat automobile reports differently from, let's say, somebody doing something out of their home or business where you don't have that mobility and normally not the same element of potential danger?
Well, certainly automobiles are mobile, but that doesn't mean that we can stop every automobile on the highway at any time.
It does mean that under the Carroll case and others, we treat them differently. Isn't that a...
Certainly. I don't think that is enough of a justification to lower the need to the amount of reasonable suspicion required to establish that this is the right vehicle or that the tip of the bad behavior is reliable, contemporaneous, based on eyewitness observation, et cetera.
Would it make a difference if the record reflected that this was received by dispatch through a 911 call?
It could make a difference.
Would that change your argument if that were true? Is that all it would take to change your position?
Oh, certainly not. I think that there are foundational factors regarding 911 calls that need to be established that certainly haven't been established here. One of the justifications for treating 911 calls differently is everybody knows they're being recorded when they call 911. And I don't think that's really that's certainly not established in this case, and I think some of the cases that have adopted that approach have glossed over that necessary foundational finding. If what makes a 911 call more reliable is that the tipster knows he can be identified, I think we need to know that the tipster does know that.
As it turned out, this tip, if it was a tip, turned out to be reliable.
Possibly. I mean, as far as this record shows us, there could have been another blue 80s van on Highway 99 weaving that night.
Because talking about the driver of the van.
Well, she was under the influence of narcotics. That is true.
The spectrum between the White case, which involved an anonymous tip with certain behavior that was confirmed,
mm-hmm.
and J.L., where would you place this case in that spectrum?
I think this case is much closer to J.L., but I also recognize that there are differences between this case and J.L. But one thing that I would really like to stress from J.L. is that some of the cases after J.L. have sort of treated J.L. as if it created an exception for firearms, that firearms aren't so dangerous that we can treat them differently. But actually what J.L. did was not make an exception. No Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court case has ever held that an anonymous tip does not require corroboration. The Supreme Court has never had that case where it says, in this case, the danger is so grave that we don't need to corroborate an anonymous tip.
About the difference between a passive possession of a weapon and the active ingredient that we have here of a potential danger to people in the area of the van.
Well, first of all, we don't know that there is anyone in the vicinity of the van. We really have very few facts here. We have blue van weaving.
We have to wait for somebody to get hit.
No, certainly we don't have to wait for someone to get hit. And that's the sort of false choice that troubles me the most, is that we have to wait for someone.
This is an active situation that is going on out in the street.
Except that it's...
Police just ignore it?
No.
For an accident to happen?
Certainly not. And the officer in this case, I would like to stress, did not witness any weaving or any other traffic violations.
Is he supposed to just follow this person? And we are talking about Highway 99. It's not an isolated rural road. And then wait to see if something happens, as Justice Chin points out, and then perhaps have the officer criticized on a personal level and the law enforcement agency perhaps subject to suit because the officer didn't take action.
Well, I think we need to go back to what our actual tip is here. We have a tip from an unknown source at an unknown time based on unknown... We can assume it was observation, but we don't have those facts, and I don't actually think it's appropriate to assume that a blue 80s van is weaving on Highway 99.
And coming in your direction.
And it's 1 o'clock, nearly 2 o'clock in the morning.
That was actually not established at the hearing. At the hearing, we have no... That was in the prosecutor's allegations in the written motion. It was not testified to at the hearing. At the hearing, we have nothing about time, and we have nothing about speed.
But can't we infer from the facts that we do know about that it was relatively contemporaneous because the weaving blue van was coming in the officer's direction?
We didn't see a weaving van in the
office. The officer doesn't have to review anything. I'm talking about the facts that we have on this record. Can't we infer that it's relatively contemporaneous?
I don't know that it's appropriate to infer contemporaneousness when we don't have...
What else could it be if the tip over the wire comes, there is a weaving blue van coming in your direction?
I think without knowing the source of the tip or the time the call came into dispatch, that's kind of a dangerous...
Would it make a difference if the tip included, this is a California license plate and the following numbers were given?
I think that makes a huge difference. I think that's one of the big problems in this case is everyone has assumed that a blue 80s van is a very specific description. I don't think there was any testimony below regarding the rarity of vans from the 80s. I noticed when I was going to the airport yesterday morning that there were four blue Honda Accords from the 1980s parked on my street, so I don't think 80s cars are quite as rare as I think it was the court below in its findings.
Follow your argument if there were four blue 80s vans coming in the officer's direction. But if there's only one, doesn't that pretty much limit...
I don't think we have testimony to the effect that there was only one blue van. I think he stopped the first blue van that he saw.
But isn't it significant that vehicle was described as traveling northbound on 99 at Airport Drive? That was just one off-ramp, on-ramp away, and 4 miles north of that location is where the officer saw them. This does involve some specificity. It's not just like Highway 99 somewhere in the Central Valley.
Well, if we look at the similar cases that have found reasonable suspicion under these situations, the identification here is so much farther. We always, in every other case where the courts have upheld this, and in several where they haven't, we have more specific color descriptions. We almost always have a license number or at least a partial license number or a description of an out-of-state plate. We have a description of an occupant, or we have the tipster stays on the phone and says, okay, yes, that's him. You're pulling over the right person. This case is so much farther that I really think that we are skipping over one of the basic in the test to determine whether the tip is reliable. One of the very first questions is, are there enough details to let us know that we have the right person? And most of the cases sort of gloss over that because they have so many more details.
Well,
aren't
you glossing over the test that the High Court set out in JL in response to a question from the bench? You said that, well, you know, you may present a different argument if in this particular case the dispatch, because as I pointed out earlier here, other than a dispatch regarding a weaving car, the prosecution presented no evidence whatsoever at trial as to the identity of the anonymous tipster or reliability pertaining to the information received from the so-called anonymous tipster. Then, as I have been listening to questions from the bench and your answers, you take your point is that in this particular case, leaving aside the anonymous tipster, although the dispatch did tell the officer who was on the highway, by the way, there is a weaving car coming into your direction. The officer himself, while waiting on the shoulder, never saw any weaving of the car, did he?
No, he didn't witness any weaving, and he didn't witness any other traffic violations.
Well, that takes me to the inquiry that prompted my questions. In the first place, you said in response to a question by Justice Kroski, yes, it would have made a great deal of difference if here somebody had said, oh, by the way, the license plate is blah, blah, blah. And my question to you is, taking a look at the test that the High Court articulated in JL, is that what the court there said was enough? any time the color of a car matches the color of the car in question, any time the car has a license plate that corroborates the information from the dispatcher, is that enough? Or are you acknowledging that when one takes a good look at the test that the High Court articulated in JL, what matters first and foremost among the various steps that the court, United States Supreme Court articulated, is the illegality that is being described? What was the illegality being described here? Would you acknowledge it was the weaving? Would you further acknowledge there was no independent observation of this so-called illegality?
Absolutely. And
Campbell, you may respond, but you've asked to reserve 15 minutes of your time. So when your answer is completed, your time.
Okay, thank you. I said that it would change my argument. I didn't say it would dispense with my argument. It only would, in this case, I'm saying that we don't even have the identification, which is usually the first and very easy step to get to. The second step is, even if you have the identification so that you know where the tip is aimed, then you look at the substance of the tip and is the tip reliable. And this, in JL, they did have a description of the young men at the bus stop, but there wasn't predictive information to support the allegation of illegal conduct. And I will reserve further responses for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. We'll hear now. Ms. Proctor.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Connie Proctor for the respondent, the people of the state of California. The pertinent question in this case is what action may a law enforcement officer take to protect the safety of both the public and the driver of a vehicle where that officer has received a contemporaneous tip from a private citizen that a person is driving in a dangerous fashion.
When you say a private tip from a private citizen, I presume you heard the colloquy between opposing counsel and me at the start of her argument. When I asked the question whether here the prosecution presented evidence that there was indeed an anonymous tip, what is your reply to that question, which I'm posing again?
Your Honor, yes, there was no information given at the suppression motion as to the identity of the caller. However, I believe that the reasonable inference here, given the fact that a call was made that specified the exact location of a car.
But that, under the test that the High Court set forth in JL, is not sufficient. You may recall, based upon the conversation that has been occurring between the bench and opposing counsel, in JL, there was a description that was given to the police about a certain man of a certain race having a gun in his possession and being at a bus stop. And the High Court, at least in my recollection, I'm not looking at the case at this very moment, said, nope, that is not enough, because then the court went on to say, what you do need is some reason to believe that the tip is, in the court's words, reliable in its assertion of illegality, not just in its tendency to identify a determinate person. I would like to know from you, taking a look at this specific language in the test articulated by the United States Supreme Court, then turning to the facts in this particular case, where all we have is certain color traveling down the highway in your direction, officer, go stop the car. And as opposing counsel has acknowledged, there was no corroborative information on the part of the detaining officer. All he knew was the information from the dispatch about this car weaving, but the officer, while waiting on the shoulder, did not observe any weaving. So again, and I apologize for the length of my question, but taking a look at the test of the High Court, that the tip has to be reliable in its assertion of illegality. What is there to satisfy this particular test that the High Court articulated in JL?
Initially, yes, Your Honor is correct that this court did state that the description given of JL at that point in time...
Well, it's not this court, it's the High Court.
I apologize. That the High Court stated that the description in JL under those circumstances was not sufficient. However, these circumstances are significantly different than the case in JL. First, in JL, there was a report of a young black man standing at a particular location wearing a plaid shirt. When the officers arrived, sometime later, we're not certain how long later after the call that the officers arrived, they saw several young black men standing at that corner, one of whom happened to be wearing a plaid shirt. This, the court found, was not sufficient under those circumstances. However, here we have a description of a vehicle which both the trial court stated was an uncommon vehicle and the appellate court stated was an uncommon vehicle. The trial court also stated that it was familiar with the area before it made that assertion that on that road that would be an uncommon vehicle.
Just clarification, in your effort to distinguish this court, this case, from JL decided by the High Court, you mentioned, well, there were several black men standing at the bus stop. I'd like to know from you, were you saying, and did I miss your assertion, that at the bus stop there were several black men in a plaid shirt?
No, not at all.
So there were only one black man in a plaid shirt?
Yes, that was the distinction between this young black man, JL, and the other young black men that were standing at that bus stop. However, I believe more importantly, even than the description given in JL and the description given here, was the fact of the matter that the crime in JL was a concealed crime. This was the case of a concealed firearm that was being held underneath someone's shirt, therefore not actively being used. In this case, in effect...
Are you asking this court to make a distinction between a car, which presumably you say, you know, can be used as a deadly weapon, and a weapon that is concealed? It's my recollection, having taken a look recently at laws pertaining to concealed firearms, that usually those persons who conceal a firearm are apt to use it for an illegal purpose. So what about the argument that when one has a tip about somebody in particular clothing at a particular bus stop having a concealed firearm, that the danger to the public is pretty big because that person can all of a sudden whip out that particular firearm and use it for an illegal purpose by shooting at a particular person or whatever?
That is a possibility. However, that does involve more steps than this case. The person would have to get the firearm from underneath his clothing,
which
pull
is no
it out.
Deal, as we know from all these cases that come up before us pertaining to the sudden exhibition of a firearm that has been concealed under a trench coat or whatever.
Yes, however, the officers did have the option of approaching this young man. They could have approached him and spoken to him. They could have also just come close by so that if they did see such action occurring, they could have stopped him at that point.
Well,
however,
was
driving...
that option available in this particular case, too, where the officer, instead of just waiting at the shoulder and the moment this blue car came into view... Can do a detention. What about the argument that just as in JL, based upon the reasoning of the High Court in JL, here the officer, the moment he saw the car come into his direction, could have followed the car to observe illegal traffic violations or whatever?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that that's not possible because an officer cannot, by any action of his own, stop a vehicle from causing an accident simply by following him. In this case, the vehicle is more like a case where if JL had been holding the weapon in his hand already, perhaps even cocked, then there was an immediate danger. Here, this person is driving and weaving all over the roadway, which is an extremely dangerous...
My last question to you, and then I'll leave you alone.
Yes.
What goes through my mind is this, and I'm looking to you for the answers. Here, the officer, as he is stopped at the shoulder, and as the car comes into view, passes the officer doesn't see any weaving.
The officer stated in his testimony that he immediately started his lights to initiate a traffic stop. He did so because of the danger inherent in a driver that's reported weaving all over the roadway. Therefore, there was no time for him to observe any weaving. Additionally, if this court...
To Justice Kennard's question is, no, he didn't see any weaving.
No, he did not see any weaving.
Is it? Could you refresh my recollection? In Florida, in the JL case, was it a crime to possess a concealed firearm regardless of whether or not it's loaded, regardless of intent? In other words, was the tip sufficient, if it had otherwise been reliable and corroborated, to allow a conclusion that a crime was being committed?
In jail, the tip was of a young black man carrying a concealed firearm. In Florida, the law was that juveniles cannot be in possession of a concealed firearm. And this juvenile was reported in the case as being 10 days shy, I believe is what the case says, of being 16. And the court did note that the officer may or may not have been able to tell, looking at this 16-year-old boy, whether or not he was a minor.
So if this individual had been an adult, merely having a gun under his clothing would not have been a crime in Florida?
I believe that's the implication. It's noted in a footnote that a juvenile carrying a gun is a crime, the implication being that an adult would not be.
Does that make a difference here? The fact that it might not have been illegal conduct that the officer was investigating, but that here, weaving all over the highway, if indeed that was the tip, is almost always not okay?
Absolutely. And the Wheat Court, in its analysis, used the tip being sufficient to compel a stop and to be sufficient in and of itself to show that there was illegality as one element to consider in the balancing test using the totality of the circumstances.
What concerns me here is, unlike JL, where the nature of the offense was concealed and the United States Supreme Court said there wasn't sufficient information to do a stop and frisk, here, the nature of the alleged illegality was open and visible. And I don't think we would be asking a police officer to follow a weaving dangerous car for any length of time. But if somebody is under the influence, the likelihood is the officer could very quickly observe it and thereby corroborate the criminal aspects of the anonymous tip.
That may be. However, that would, in effect, totally nullify the anonymous tip itself. If the officer saw a car weaving all over the roadway, it would not need an anonymous tip in order to pull that car over. There would be no reason for the tip whatsoever. Additionally, because it was a major highway, the 99 freeway, and this person was reported as weaving all over the road, the imminent danger is significant.
But simply, corroboration would be instantaneous.
Not necessarily. There, in my own experience, seeing a police car following me may alter my own driving. And in this case,
isn't it unrealistic to assume that once one's weaving, one is always going to be weaving? There are certainly periods during which a person under the influence would be more likely to weave than not. It isn't a constant, is it? It might depend upon road conditions, whether there are curves in the road, other factors, or just the effects of the alcohol.
Exactly. The effects of the alcohol may change a person. Even if it wasn't alcohol, if it was an illness, if the person was feeling faint, they may start to feel faint and then wake up. If they're falling asleep, they may start to fall asleep and then wake up. The danger is continuing, even though the weaving has stopped for that brief moment.
Well, based on your argument, then, one concern I would have is that anybody could call and say I'm driving, and they don't like the way I looked at them as I passed them, or whatever it might be, and just make a call to dispatch and describe my car and say what they like about my alleged illegal driving, and I'm subject to a stop.
That may be, Your Honor. However, the Wheat Court also addressed that and stated that the risk in and of itself is de minimis. And additionally, the intrusion of a traffic stop is so de minimis as to, in this situation, allow that, even if the driver of the car is not driving illegally, the danger presented, should that driver have been weaving all over the road, the danger outweighs the brief intrusion. In our state, we allow traffic stops for almost any reason. A police officer can stop a car for a broken taillight or having its windows tinted too darkly. A police officer can stop a car for almost anything. And so a brief stop of just a few minutes.
Now, what occurs at the time of the stop? The police officer flashes his lights, pull over, and then what transpires?
Approaches the vehicle, most likely asks for identification, and then would simply observe the driver. Were their eyes bloodshot? Was there an odor of alcohol or drugs in the car? Was the person able to speak clearly? Was a person able to answer certain simple questions? If all of these things are in order, then the officer simply hands back the identification and the driver continues after just a free brief moment.
If I understand your position correctly, you're saying that it's a weighing process, and against the rather hypothetical situation of an individual motorist wanting to single out somebody else to get that person stopped, we have to weigh the consequences of letting somebody who's under the influence continue driving with the peril.
Yes, the reasonableness inquiry is always a balancing test between the intrusion presented on the defendant or the suspect and the government's interest in making the stop.
This is different from, let's say, some pattern of discrimination where you might have officers singling out certain types of people categorically for stops, as opposed to here a citizen not likely to be singling out somebody for some nefarious purpose.
Yes, and in this case, it's more likely that this was a private citizen completely unassociated with the driver of the car, because drunk driving is an instance of opportunity or necessity or whatever the driver may say, the reason why they were driving while impaired. The other cases that the High Court has considered have all been cases that either imply, as the court has stated, that when there's possession of a gun, then there's the implication of illegality, or they're drug cases where there's a continuing criminal enterprise, where a tipster who has knowledge of these continuing criminal enterprises may be inferred to be a part of that in some way and may have some sort of guilt of themselves.
Here, in White, the court itself referred to the facts there as being a close case. And there you had certain predicted movements that were corroborated by observation. If that was a close case, why isn't this case even a closer case, where there is no corroboration other than description?
Well, this is a close case. However, the key element here is that drunk driving is an open crime that any member of the public can see. There is no need for a tipster to provide either predictive information or any other information showing that they have inside information. This is something that happens on a major highway. Any other motorist would see it happen, and by making the report itself, the informant would necessarily tell something about themselves. They would tell their location. It's implied that they were also a motorist at that same place. Here, the caller called in exactly the location of the car, and the car was found just 2 to 3 minutes later. And the Wheat Court found it significant that showing your location lessens the anonymity of the caller.
You were speaking of Alabama versus White?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, also, isn't it a closer case because we don't have that peril in the balancing process of a moving vehicle out on the highways? White, as I recall, involved a woman who was believed to be seen to have a quantity of cocaine, and arguably the consequences of whether she stopped or not are less in overall context of things than allowing somebody to proceed.
Yes, exactly. Although there may be dangerous repercussions in the future from carrying a controlled substance, in and of itself, driving a car with a controlled substance in your car does not present an imminent danger either to the public or to yourself. Whereas driving a car while under the influence or weaving all over the road for whatever reason is an imminent danger to both the public and to the driver of the vehicle.
And didn't the subsequently discovered facts after the stop of the vehicle confirm that this was indeed a dangerous situation?
Yes, it did. There was not only the presence of controlled substances in the car, but the driver was also found to be under the influence. Additionally, as to answer some of the questions that were posed to counsel, although we do not know exactly the time that the caller made the call, and we do not know the location of that caller or the basis of her knowledge, we cannot abandon common sense in this case. The call was made that stated that the car, a moving vehicle, was at a specific location on a major highway, and it was found exactly at the right place at the wrong right time. 3 miles up the road, 3 minutes later, highway driving, that's exactly right. And the inference must be that that person saw that vehicle.
Or at least that is one reasonable inference.
That is one reasonable inference. Any other reasonable inference escapes me at the moment.
Maybe that person always drives past that location at that hour because they're getting off work.
That may be. However, anticipating the exact minute, within 2 to 3 minutes, on a major highway such as this, it would be nearly impossible. Of course, it is possible. However, logically, common sense would lead to the inference that that person was observing this as a contemporaneous observation, and that it is a citizen witness who is just driving on the same road and sees this erratic driving. Additionally, the fact that this caller felt the need to call the police also shows how dangerous this person was. If the person was merely weaving within her lane, as was suggested, the caller would probably not have felt the need to call the police and would not have described it as weaving all over the road. This case, as stated earlier, is different from JL in several ways. First, it is an open crime, so there is no need to show that there was inside information because it was not a concealed crime. Also, it's a currently occurring crime. It's not a potential future crime or a past crime, as some of the other cases that were cited by appellant's counsel were. Appellant also made a comment about in her brief that there was no description of the driver. However, in this instance, there was no need to describe the driver. The cases that describe the driver of a vehicle generally are cases involving guns or a threat that was made by a particular person or a robbery that was perpetrated by particular people. In this case, all that a citizen needs to see that this is erratic driving is to see the vehicle. They don't need to see the driver at all. Additionally, in JL, we don't know the timing. In JL, they said that sometime later the officers appeared. Here we know that it was merely 2 to 3 minutes and that there was an imminent danger. And because citizen witnesses are presumed to be reliable, absent something to cast doubt on their reliability, this witness should be believed. In conclusion, Officer Irigoyen was justified in making the initial stop to determine whether additional facts existed to further corroborate the anonymous caller's tip that defendant was involved in a criminal conduct that posed an imminent threat to safety. The officer had a duty to protect the public and to protect the driver of the vehicle. And the best way to do that was to stop this vehicle. This was not a pedestrian that he could merely approach and speak with, ask a simple question of, or observe from close by and potentially stop a danger. In a vehicle, the only way to stop the peril is to stop the driver, and the only way to ask a brief question of a driver is to stop the vehicle. And finally, cars are considered less private. A person has less of an expectation of privacy while driving in a car. They are in a public, they are highly regulated, and it was a much less of an intrusion, a brief traffic stop, than the stop and frisk which was perpetrated in JL. And if there are no further questions, I will submit.
Apparently none. Thank you, Ms. Proctor. Ms. Campbell, you may argue in rebuttal.
There are two issues that have come up here that are troubling me a little bit. The first is the idea that we can justify this stop based on the fact that it turned out to be correct, that the driver was under the influence, because that's not how we approach Fourth Amendment issues. We don't justify a search based on what it turns up. What we look at is whether or not the officer had reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime was being committed when he made the stop. And that gets me back to the second issue that troubled me from the recent comments, which was that we allow officers to stop cars for almost any reason in California.
The roadway permits an inference of what kind of behavior, in your view, other than that the person is very probably drunk?
Well, certainly there's lots of things that can cause, unfortunately, talking on a cell phone is one of them, ironically enough, if that was what the call here was made through a cell phone. Obviously, there's things that happen in cars.
And I agree that being and driving under the influence is certainly one reasonable inference that can be drawn from somebody being described in that with those characters.
Certainly. And I think that if the officer had witnessed weaving all over the road, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be having this argument right now.
I'm talking about somebody who obviously has been encouraged, and apparently, to call in
mm-hmm.
to report what they see on the roadway. That appears to be what the inference of what happened here, because of the contemporaneous events that we see. But I'm just trying to find out what your view is. What should be in that call to meet the test that you feel JL puts forward?
I would say, first of all, the caller's name. I've made these calls myself on the road, but I always give my name, and then we don't have an anonymous tip, or we have a different type of tip, and we're in a very different situation. And other things that should be in that call are a license number. I think a better description of the vehicle, so we can be sure we're not stopping innocent vehicles.
That's not always so easy to obtain high speed with weaving, is it?
Certainly it's not, but I do notice that most of the cases that are discussed in the briefing, and a lot of them that I didn't discuss in the briefing, do include a license number.
Well, let me ask you this. You've given some examples. You've posited various explanations for weaving. You just mentioned use of a cell phone. I think you mentioned earlier tending to a child, whatever. Do we really care? If an officer hears through one source or another that somebody is weaving all over the road, that person is a hazard, whether that weaving is due to the consumption of alcohol, whether it's due to being inattentive because one is speaking on the phone or adjusting the radio or tending to a child or trying to retrieve an object that they dropped on the floor. And that weaving behavior may recur. So that person's just as much of a danger, even though there are other explanations in addition to the reasonable explanation of driving under the influence of a drug or of alcohol.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I don't want to get distracted onto whether or not weaving is not a stoppable offense. If the officer sees weaving, certainly that's an issue. But the problem is that we have to look at where this source comes from, because I keep just being tripped up by the fact that the High Court has never said that some situations are so dangerous that an anonymous tip doesn't need corroboration. I would have thought that JL would, frankly, I was surprised that JL went the way that it did, because a concealed weapon out in public, certainly a dangerous situation.
That's passive. That's not as dangerous as, in the words of the information reaching the officer, weaving all over the highway. To me, that's far more dangerous. It would seem a person can passively pack a weapon and never display it, perhaps just have it for defensive purposes or possibly not defensive purposes, but potential zone of harm of somebody who's weaving all over the highway, to me, seems much greater.
So, but the question isn't just, is it dangerous and does it require a stop? The question is it so dangerous that it requires this court to adopt a per se rule that any time there's a tip, no matter how unreliable, how uncorroborated, that that someone is driving erratically, that the officer can forego the normal law enforcement corroboration and just make a stop. I think that is what we really need to focus on, is it so dangerous that we dispense with Florida v. JL, and that, frankly, we dispense with Alabama versus White, because we're skipping over a lot of the steps that were outlined in that case as well.
Would it be your view that the dispatch person interrogates the caller and can't get the name and can't get a driver's license, can't get any more information than we have here, should not bother to forward it to the officer in the area?
Absolutely not. I think that if the tip is not corroborated, it can still be a tip, and there are other ways to corroborate it other than waiting to see the person weave again. We've all seen enough.
So your view would be to go ahead and send it to the officer, but his duty or her duty at that time would simply be to follow the car until the behavior was repeated.
Not necessarily that behavior, but certainly that's always an officer's duty when he receives an uncorroborated tip, is to investigate it. And we've seen the cases. We know that officers, trained CHP officers, they can recognize a drunk driver before he weaves. Not always, but they certainly can. They see behavior sitting too close to the wheel, driving far below the speed limit. There's delayed reactions. We've reviewed the cases. I see drunk driving cases all the time, and I know this court does as well, and that there are behaviors that CHP officers can observe. This officer didn't have time to observe those behaviors, but I don't think we just should assume that he wouldn't have, and that this would have continued without a stop. The Chief Justice mentioned a weighing process and balancing, and I think that if we want to see where that balancing test comes from, we only need to look back to Alabama v. White. The court there, the court in White set forth a very simple test. It's a totality of the circumstances test. The anonymous tip alone seldom demonstrates the informant's basis of knowledge of veracity, but so you need to have information that will supply those sources, and we don't have those in this case.
But the balancing that the court was confronted with in Alabama versus White was on the danger side, the danger of a woman bringing some heroin into a motel. Wasn't that the case? As opposed to the arguably far more dangerous and immediate consequences of somebody weaving all over the highway.
Certainly, but we don't even get to the question of weaving without believing this tip, without having some threshold of reliability for this tip. And in every other case, the cases that have adopted the Wheat test, in Wheat itself, there was always a greater threshold of reliability. There was a phone call from somebody on the highway. There was a closer identification, a more specific identification. Of all the close cases, and the term close case comes up over and over again, it was in JL, it was in White, it was in the New Hampshire Supreme Court in Sousa, and the court below here, all these close cases, this case is by far the closest. We have fewer facts than any of those other cases. If this court upholds the search in this case, we will be in uncharted territory. We'll have gone so far afield of the U.S. Supreme Court that we will have the most permissive standard in the nation, as far as I've been able to determine, where we have no specific identification. We don't know where the call came from. We don't know what the basis of the caller's observation was. And all we have is a blue van weaving all over the highway and a stop of a blue van in the same area.
Would it make a difference if there had been a Harvey Madden motion and the tape itself was in the courtroom and listened?
There might have been a difference. I think Harvey Madden generally applies to law enforcement sources, and I don't know if this came through civilian 911 or if it was a direct call to dispatch, which
Right, but had the tape been in the courtroom and the trial court, and let's assume the trial court hears an unidentified person say in a very agitated voice, there's somebody in a blue van at the corner of Awful and Terrible speeding down Highway 599. You should send somebody right away. Click.
We might have a different case. We might have a very similar case. We don't know what was on those tapes, and unfortunately, it's the.
Well, I'm giving you the facts. Would that be more? Would that be less troubling to you?
It would be less troubling to me. Although I still think we need to go through the steps of corroboration, and in that, under the facts you've given us, we might have those steps. That's certainly not the case before the court here.
What you're trying to prevent is that this is something that the police made up.
You know, I don't think it's really a question of the police making it up. I actually take some issue with the Wheat Court's characterization of the risk of false tips being de minimis. I don't know if they don't have road rage in the Eighth Circuit, but we certainly have it in California.
In this case, we know that the police did not make this up.
I think I'm certainly not alleging that the police made it up.
Facts would indicate otherwise.
Yes. Well, that, once again, that's going to what the search turned up, but I don't think...
I'm talking about the tip that there is a blue van weaving all over the place coming in your direction, and sure enough, the van is coming in his direction.
There is a blue van that comes in his direction. I'm certainly not suggesting that the dispatch call was made up.
But I presume your point is that applying the test that the High Court articulated in JL, what matters is some corroboration of illegal activity. Listening to your argument, would it be correct to summarize your argument as follows? Here, the detaining officer observed no improper driving conduct, and, as you have argued, the prosecution presented no evidence whatsoever about the identity of the alleged tipster, nor did it present evidence of the basis for the alleged tipster's assertion that defendant's car was weaving, or the circumstances in which the alleged call was made. So presumably, wrapping all that up, your argument to this court is, in a nutshell, the prosecution failed to show that the police were aware of facts giving rise to a reasonable suspicion that defendant was engaging in criminal activity.
That is exactly my argument, Your Honor. That is exactly the argument and the situation in a nutshell.
Let me ask you this. You have stated that if we were to rule against your client, we'd be way out in front and, in effect, departing from established U.S. Supreme Court precedents. But isn't it significant that the JL case of the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with a weapons matter, the Alabama versus White case dealt with narcotics, both of those not in the context of the mobility and imminent danger posed by a moving vehicle. We don't really know what the U.S. Supreme Court would rule applying principles in the area of a moving vehicle that exhibits to some sort, anonymous that it is, a potential danger by way of weaving. We don't really know that. So I think you're sort of making an assumption that we would be out of step with U.S. Supreme Court precedents when we don't know, because the court hasn't ruled yet, on how these principles apply in an area that it has viewed as quite unique and different. Way back to the 1920s Carroll case and all the progeny, a moving vehicle.
Well, I do think we do know that the U.S. Supreme Court has never said that there is any kind of anonymous tip that does not require corroboration. It has never said that. The jurisprudence from the United States Supreme Court is an anonymous tip requires corroboration. In Florida v. JL, the court first made its ruling and then said we are not going to apply a firearm exception. The only hint we have from the High Court is the little tossed-up language about if this were an allegation of a bomb. And the court didn't even say that in that case you might not require corroboration. I think we can all imagine the situation where someone says, you know, if there'd been a...
They said they were not going to discuss it in that context.
Exactly.
What they were talking about was not that kind of situation.
Exactly.
In effect, reserving that issue, were they not?
I don't know that they were reserving the issue or that they were just saying... this is not the case before us. But
don't we have something that's more akin to a ticking bomb than the passive possession of an unlawful weapon?
I'd say it falls somewhere between the two extremes, but I'm not prepared to say that an allegation of weaving on the highway is the same as a ticking bomb.
Would it be correct to say that the majority of courts that have considered this a DUI, anonymous tip situation, have come out against you?
You may respond to Justice Moreno's question, but your time is otherwise up.
Thank you. It is definitely correct to say that the majority of the courts that have considered the issue have found that there was reasonable suspicion, but also the majority of those courts have employed a totality of the circumstances test. Even if they talk about a drunk driving exception, they're still dealing with a far more specific identification, and generally a call, we know the source of the call even if we don't know the identity of the caller. Thank you.
The matter stands submitted, and we are in recess until 1:30. All rise.